Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on your questions about what the president's immigration order really says and what it does. There's been so much confusion about last Friday's executive order that banned immigrants from some specific countries that we thought it would be valuable to open the phone lines, invite you to call in and tweet in with some questions. We're also going to talk about the history of immigration restrictions and what it means for what happened last week. So here's what we know so far about the order. It affects seven countries that include Iraq, Iran, and Sudan. It is in effect for 90 days. There are exceptions. We'll talk about who and why. The acting attorney general, Sally Yates, was fired when she refused to enforce it. And the leaders of many countries, including Germany, Canada, and Iran, have condemned the order. As our guests join us, I want to ask you what kinds of questions you have about what this executive order means. Is it something that will affect your family, perhaps someone in your circle of friends? Are you curious about the history of immigration and limits? Erica Lee is with us today, and she knows a lot about the history, so we'll talk about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. It's K-E-R-R-I-N-P-R. Kevin Johnson is with us. He's a professor of public interest law and Chicano studies at the UC Davis. And he joins us today from Davis, California. And Kevin, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Erica Lee is with us. She's a historian and director of the Immigration History Research Center at the University of Minnesota, and she's with me in the studio. And welcome, Erica. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Kevin, this is a legal question to you first. Sean Spicer took great exception to a reporter who suggested that this was a ban, Sean Spicer being the spokesperson for the Trump administration. He said it's not a ban because it's limited and it only delays entry. It doesn't end it for these people coming in from seven countries. Is it a ban in your view, and is it a ban legally?
Well, it's certainly a ban for 90 days, and it is open to extension. And as far as we can tell at this point, there's going to be an indefinite hold on visa admissions from people from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen. And that's not likely, at least in the short term, to be lifted. So I do think it's certainly a suspension, and it's focusing on countries that are predominantly Muslim, and it's indefinite in duration, really. It starts at 90 days, and it goes on from there. So I can understand why people think of it as a ban. And it doesn't sound like we're hearing anything from the administration like this is going to be lifted shortly.
That's right. Yeah. Erica, I want to ask you about the religious part of this. You know that there are many people calling this a Muslim ban. There are still many countries with a majority of Muslim people who are not on this list. Do you see this as a Muslim ban? And then I want to ask you about the history of that.
Sure. I do see it as a Muslim ban, and it's right. In the executive order, religion is not explicitly included as a reason for this ban. However, if you look at the language carefully, there's coded language in there describing what we know in the public discourse, and certainly from this administration, is specifically targeting Muslims. So a reference to those who would oppress Americans with their violent political ideology, those who might commit honor killings. So if you connect that language with what candidate and now President Trump has said about radical Islam, the two pieces come together, and it's very clear that it is specifically targeting Muslims.
Have we ever had immigration restrictions before that specifically point to peoples of a certain faith from other places?
Absolutely. The very first national political debate that we had in the mid-19th century targeted Irish Catholics.
Okay.
And if you go back to those public speeches, the newspapers of the so-called Know-Nothing Party, the American Party, you could literally replace the word Catholic with the word Muslim, and it would seem very common today, very familiar. Catholics were considered incompatible because of their religious beliefs and traditions, incompatible to American society and institutions.
What was the outcome of that debate back then?
It was a rigorous national debate that was very popular in the 1850s, but then kind of petered out over the issue of slavery. But they had many governors who were in support of immigration restriction, and it really marks the first time that a political movement uses immigration as a wedge issue to get people to the polls and to vote. Interestingly enough, they never recommended for immigration restriction. They really just wanted to give those Irish Catholics more time to assimilate. So it's very similar, but also different than what
we
see today.
You said it was the first time, certainly hasn't been the last, and we've seen this over the course of the centuries and the decades a number of times, haven't we?
Absolutely. So when we're thinking about this immigration law as a ban, we historians can cite numerous examples, beginning with the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, which was really the first time that we singled out a specific group for exclusion. The current ban, I have to say, is more restrictive than that ban, which President Franklin Roosevelt repealed and called a historic mistake. But the most similar ban is actually a law that will be recognizing a 100-year anniversary in just a few days. It's the 1917 Immigration Act. It actually circled all of Asia and designated it a barred zone. No immigrants from all of Asia could come in after 1917.
Kevin, a call for you from Katie in Minneapolis. Hi, Katie. What are you thinking about?
Hi. I am really concerned and very curious about what changes in vetting this administration is saying needs to happen. It seems to me that they're perpetuating a myth that vetting isn't happening, and yet it's a 12 to 24-month process from what I understand. So I'd just love to hear some clarification on what specific changes they're proposing need to be made.
Kevin, can you answer that?
Yes, I can. I think the question is a very good one. If you read the executive order, you get the sense that there's not much review and vetting of refugees in particular before they're admitted to the United States. The truth is, under the Overseas Refugee Admissions Program, there's vetting by the Department of State, by the Department of Homeland Security, by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And as you said, some of these procedures take years. And so refugees who are basically being barred from admission for 4 months at the get-go are heavily vetted, actually more vetted than any other group of immigrants to the United States. And to suggest that vetting hasn't been appropriate when there's been no showing of any problems with refugees admitted here seems to be misguided, if not just trying to capitalize on the unpopularity of some groups of refugees. So I think we don't know precisely, since the order isn't very specific and talks in sort of some vague terms about what's going to happen, but we do know that the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security is told to look at this and the process for admissions, that there's not going to be any visa waivers, interview waivers anymore. There's going to be an interview of every visa applicant. Mm. And there's going to be a look at what needs to be done to improve the process, but we don't know precisely at this point what it's going to be. We do know that over the course of the weekend, that even lawful permanent residents, those people who have green cards who were coming back into the country, who are nationals of one of the seven nations listed in the executive order, were being interrogated, thoroughly detained, and questioned for many hours. So it seems like there was some efforts, and those may continue to carefully scrutinize people from those seven nations, even if they're lawful permanent residents. And the press secretary, Mr. Spicer, he basically said that in sort of going back and forth about what was going on. I have to say, it does appear that there's some lack of communication within the administration, because the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security didn't know
yes.
That the executive order did not apply to green card holders, and seemed somewhat surprised when that was clarified for him and had to issue a separate statement. And since he didn't know, that means the people at the border entries didn't know. And there seems to be a sort of a mass confusion here, in part because of a lack of communication and in part because a lack of clarity in the executive order about what's supposed to be done.
For listeners here, if you've just tuned in, it's a conversation about some of the specific details of what this executive order that President Trump signed regarding immigration limitations last Friday. And if you haven't had a chance to read the actual order, here's an important couple of sentences from it. The order says, "I hereby suspend entry into the United States as immigrants and non-immigrants of such persons for 90 days from the date of this order." And then there is a list of 7 specific countries that this applies to, including Iran, Sudan, and a number of other countries. Just some context on that for you. Conversation here and opening the phone lines. If you have specific questions, perhaps you have some semi-legal questions. I don't know that we can solve your own personal situation, but if you have some general legal questions, I think that would be valuable here. Kevin Johnson from UC Davis can help us with that. And Erica Lee is in the studio with me. She's a historian, and she's the director of the Immigration History Research Center at the U of M. And if you've got questions or observations about the history of this and what that means, good time for that as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Lots of calls. If you're getting a busy signal, call us back. You can reach me on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR. Anthony, Kevin says on Twitter, "My husband has conditional green card. There have been detentions of LPRs from countries not on the list. Should I be worried about this?" What's an LPR, by the way?
LPR is a lawful permanent resident, and a conditional lawful permanent resident is somebody who probably recently married a U.S. citizen and is given sort of a probationary green card to ensure that their marriage wasn't a fraud or something like that. So I think the truth of the matter is, and I don't know the specifics of this case, but I think that every lawful permanent resident who's traveling abroad should be worried about what might happen at the border. I don't want to, build up some kind of hysteria, but I do know we have law faculty who are naturalized citizens from Iran who aren't leaving the country for fear of what might happen. And there's a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of confusion, frankly, as I mentioned before, in the administration. I would be very careful in these times if you're a lawful permanent resident or any other a temporary visitor who's come to the United States. It's a frightening time.
Erica, go ahead.
And I want to point out that the language of the executive order actually leaves open the possibility that other countries could be added.
You know, we have a question about that, too. So let me go to that on the phones to Anna in St. Paul. Hey, Anna. Hi. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, of course. Not a problem. So my question relates to the Friday, or I have two questions, actually. So the first question related to the Friday order. So in the executive order issued Friday, it's sort of been pitched by the administration as a temporary ban on immigration and refugee resettlement refugee resettlement as a whole and immigration from certain countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose of this is so that the governments of these countries can provide evidence to the United States that it has proper vetting before it'll allow the admission of immigrants.
Okay.
So my question is, for countries, so let's say, for example, Syria, which is in the middle of a civil war, or Somalia, which has effectively been a failed state for many years, isn't it likely that this could turn into a de facto semi-permanent ban?
Erica?
And then yeah.
Absolutely. I think you raise an extremely important question. Syria, Somalia, who are the government officials who could provide this evidence that is unspecified, by the way, unspecified evidence in terms of extreme vetting to satisfy the new administration? So that's very troubling. The other thing, and I know that many are pointing out that this is a temporary ban, 90 days for all travel, 120 days. However, we know that temporary bans have often turned into multi-year bans. There's nothing in the executive order that says that this will absolutely end after that time period. They're going to go through some review, but it very easily could turn into a longer ban.
And Erica, could there be other countries? Is there anything to stop the administration from adding some other countries to the seven?
The executive order specifically allows the Department of Homeland Security to add additional countries.
And Anna, briefly, you had a second part to the question?
Yeah, so the second question I had, and this relates to Friday's executive order suspending refugee resettlement and also Wednesday's executive order sort of limiting the ability of asylum seekers to go through a credible fear interview, which is the first seven
briefly,
requesting asylum.
We have a lot of people on the lines.
I apologize. Is this potentially a violation of our treaty obligations under the 1951 Refugee Convention?
Erica or Kevin, which one of you wants to tackle it? Kevin, do you want to tackle that one?
I can. I think that's a very good point. I think 1951 Refugee Convention and the 1967 UN Protocol relating to the status of refugees are both arguably violated by a bar, a complete bar for a period of time of refugee admissions to the United States. These are people who established they have a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, political opinion, nationality, religion, or membership in a particular social group, and you just say we're not taking them, they're staying where they are, certainly is not consistent with international law, and I think we'll see some claims and lawsuits challenging that.
And Kevin, Johnny says here on Twitter, my wife has a green card. She was born in Somalia. She's terrified of leaving the country. How can we guarantee that she'll be treated fairly? If I heard you right, you were saying beware of leaving the country right now. Is that true?
I don't want to create a kind of hysteria, but I certainly would be very careful, and I would probably consult with an immigration attorney right now to make sure that if you have to go for whatever reason, that you go in the least risky way. And I regret having to say that, but that's my general view.
A call here from Tim in Eagan. Hi, Tim.
Hi. You know, I'm just curious about how these seven nations were specifically carved out and why others were left off.
The seven nations, so Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Libya, Yemen, and Syria, they were, as the administration has pointed out, already on a list that President Obama had specifically identified. The difference, however, is that under the Obama administration, the changes in immigration from those countries was that immigrants from those countries would be placed under individual review and that they would not be automatically granted or participate in what we have as the visa waiver program. What the executive order does differently now is not allow that individual review of specific immigrants, but as the order makes clear, institute an all-out ban.
And Erica, to clarify something, when President Obama put that temporary restriction on Iraq, that was in 2011,
mm-hmm.
wasn't it? Okay. How long was that in force and what happened when it expired?
I'm not sure. Maybe Kevin can
answer
the question.
Kevin, would you be able to answer that?
No, that was in force for a couple of years and expired a couple of years after that. But I do think what Erica's point is a good one, that this was not a ban on all migration from particular countries. This was sort of special procedures that were applied in individual cases. And even special registration that was instituted by the Bush administration was much more narrow and fine-tuned and carefully crafted than this seven-country ban, temporary or indefinite, is how you want to look at it. So I do think this is just very different than anything we've seen in recent memory.
Ivan asks here, Kevin, on Twitter, I'm curious how banning travel based on nationality alone and providing preferential treatment based on religion is constitutional. And let me note here that there are exceptions for Christians in Syria who want to come into the United States. They are not being stopped under this executive order. Can you address Ivan's question there?
No, I think that's a very good question, and one of the central claims in a number of lawsuits, including the lawsuit that the state of Minnesota recently intervened in and became a part of, is the claim that this order violates equal protection of the laws under the 5th and 14th Amendments, and that having a blanket exclusion on people from particular nations with certainly religious overtones, if not overtones, it's unconstitutional. And there's also a claim that it's not just nationality based, but religious based, and should be struck down on that ground as well. So I think that there's constitutional challenges. There's also a part of the Immigration Act of 1965 that amended the Immigration Nationality Act that requires for non-discrimination in visa issuance, non-discrimination based on nationality and other factors, and this seems to run contrary to that.
If you've just had a chance to listen into the show, we are taking questions and trying to sort out the details of this executive order on immigration that President Trump signed last Friday. You saw the protests in response. You saw a lot of confusion at the borders, and now some time has passed, and we still have many questions about who it applies to and what it means and how long it's going to last and why are there only a specific 7 countries on this list. So Erica Lee with us from the Immigration History Research Center at the U of M, and Kevin Johnson, a professor of public interest law and Chicano studies at UC Davis, helping us out with that. If you have a question about the history of immigration restrictions, limitations, good opportunity for that. If you have a question about a specific query about who this immigration restriction order applies to, we have guests that can handle that as well. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Just want to note here that while we're talking about immigration, tonight Indivisible Radio comes out of Minnesota Public Radio tonight, and I will be talking about how these changes to immigration and the kind of debate we've been having around immigration influences American identity, influences the way we see ourselves individually and collectively. So that's on tonight at 7 o'clock. Tweet in, call in. I'd love to have your views. It's a national call-in on that. Back to the phones to Masood in Minneapolis. Good morning, Masood. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here, man.
Of course. Well, your question or your comment for us?
I actually have a question and a comment to you. So I'm a Muslim American. My question is, if you look at the rhetoric that was during the elections and you tie that all into the executive order that was issued last weekend on Muslim ban, what happens if this Muslim, there's a strong sense, I think, among Muslim community probably, that this ban will probably be extended to more countries 6 months or 8 months down the road, which basically means the list might increase to another 20, 25 countries a year later. And then all of a sudden they start encroaching on the rights of Muslim Americans who are citizens or green card holders just because they have built up a case by doing these soft blows, saying that, hey, you know, we have a problem outside, we think we have a problem inside as well, and we need to really do something about it, too. How does that encroach on our rights and, you know, what really we should be doing?
Kevin, tackle that first, but then I'd love to hear what Erica has to say about it, too.
Well, I think that's a legitimate concern, and I think that Muslim Americans who have family members who are trying to immigrate to the United States may be adversely affected by the inability or the unwillingness of government to issue visas to those family members. And I do think the Supreme Court has made pretty clear that individual, at least if you're a U.S. citizen and are trying to bring in a family member, that generally speaking, you can bring a court action and try to ensure that person is allowed to come to the United States. But that is burdensome, it is time consuming, and it's not easy. And I think that that's a real problem. The underlying concern is this going to be expanded to other nations? I know that there's a worry in the community that could well happen. I find it hard, frankly, to predict how this administration might act in this regard. I do think that the political response and the litigation response and the worldwide uproar over this order, at least the one from last Friday, in a normal set of circumstances would get the administration to think carefully about proceeding in the future. I can't say the case for this administration because it seems to be so unique in so many different ways. So it's, I have to say, it's hard for me to predict what might happen. Could we see an expansion in the number of countries listed? I think we could. Do I think that we should continue if we're worried about the civil rights and other impacts of these orders? Do I think we should continue to voice that concern? And I think we very much should.
Kevin, just a note, though, on public opinion. You know, I have to say I was surprised to see polls somewhere in the 40s of Americans who believe what President Trump has done so far on immigration is all right, that they approve of it. So when I hear you saying, you know, usually an administration would be aware of pushback of public opinion. Well, he's hearing from plenty of people who think this is fine, including, I might add, members of Congress.
There's some members of Congress he's hearing that from, but it's ordinarily the case. You don't see mass protests in response, you know, grassroots mass protests.
Agreed.
On the weekend immediately after an order is issued. This is actually quite extraordinary in this way, where an order is released on Friday afternoon in part to try to minimize public protest. A grassroots network quickly emerges, and airports are the areas of protests around the country. It's hard for me to read the polls. There are some people who support this. There are some people who very much don't. I think it's unfortunate in some respects that historically you at various times in U.S. history have seen strong support for measures that punished immigrants of a variety of backgrounds, whether it's the Irish or the Chinese or the Japanese or Mexican immigrants, and now it's Muslims today. So I do think, and your point is a good one, we can't just rely on the political process, and that's why so many organizations and why at least two states so far and why the city of San Francisco have decided to resort to the courts, which are supposed to protect minorities from violation of constitutional rights by government.
Yeah, I want to make sure, Erica, that no one hears me saying, well, if the public thinks it's okay, then it must be constitutional and okay. I am pointing out, though, that when administrations are often susceptible to public pressure, this administration is also hearing from some people who think this is right. Now, to our original question, if you can.
Sure. I mean, one of the things you hear Kevin and I saying consistently over this our time together is we hate to incite or contribute to any sense of hysteria. However, there's really no getting around the fact that this is quite unprecedented in so many ways. One of your earlier callers had to specifically say the immigration executive order on Friday. We can't forget that this was the third immigration-related executive order in 1 week that had such a broad impact on all aspects of immigration policy, and how unprecedented that is as coming from the executive branch. The Congress has not had a chance to debate this. And I think that's why it's not just the mass protests in the streets and city hall and at the airports, but also we're seeing lawsuits by states as well as corporations. So the public opinion polls certainly demonstrate the continued divide of American public opinion over immigration. However, I do think that the international response, the corporate response, as well as the grassroots community response could have some sway in how these executive orders get rolled out, what gets changed, if new countries will be added or not.
Call here from Kelsey in Golden Valley. Hi, good morning, Kelsey. I appreciate you waiting.
Yeah. My question is, I know I've heard a lot of people talking about how the executive order is extremely broad. And I know when, for example, Congress passes a law, you can strike that law down by, you know, declaring that it's, you know, overly broad, it's unconstitutional. Is there the same possibility to do that with an executive order?
Kevin, can you answer that?
No, I think you're exactly right. Ordinarily, when Congress passes legislation, it does so after having hearings, after having reports from various committees, and having a vote by the Senate and the House. legislation. It's not always the case. It tends to get some scrutiny before it's enacted into law. And here, you have an executive order that is short and is brief and makes some broad assertions, some of which may be true, but some of which may not be. It's hard to say. They're so broad and so vague. And even linking this current executive order with the September 11 attacks, but there's no findings, there's no evidence offered, there's very little in terms of detail, but sort of broad statements. And I think in the end, when a court reviews this, it is, as one of the previous listeners said, going to connect up this order with a campaign rhetoric where candidate Trump did say he was going to ban Muslims coming to the United States, and then he backed down and said, well, maybe we'll have extreme vetting of Muslims. And then he backed down and said, oh, maybe we'll just focus on people from particular countries, understanding that religious distinctions in our laws are suspect and often stricken down by the Supreme Court. I think in this circumstance, the fact that it's an executive order with very few findings, with very little evidence, without hearings, without details, without specifics, and it discriminates in a way that we rarely see in American law, is going to create a problem for the U.S. government in the courts.
We are taking as many of your questions and your observations on this executive order, specifically on the one that President Trump signed on Friday afternoon, taking note of what Erica said. This was the third immigration executive order. Taking your calls and your questions here about who this actually applies to, what it means for people who are traveling back and forth, and then some of these larger historical and philosophical questions as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Julie says, so many conflicts with this order and potentially with future orders. How can it possibly be upheld? I think we've addressed what may happen in the courts. You can tweet me at Carrie NPR. A look at the latest news and then right back to the conversation. Phil, what are you leading with this hour?
Hi, Carrie. Warning that religious freedom is under threat. President Trump is vowing to repeal the Johnson Amendment and IRS rule barring pastors from endorsing candidates from the pulpit. At a prayer breakfast this morning, Trump said representatives of faith must be able to speak freely and without fear of retribution. President Trump is suggesting the University of California at Berkeley could lose its federal funding after canceling last night's appearance by a polarizing editor of Breitbart News. The university says there was a safety concern after some 1,500 people turned out for a protest and then became violent, breaking windows and setting fires. Trump tweeted, if UC Berkeley does not allow free speech, no federal funds. National Security Advisor Michael Flynn says Iran is on notice for testing ballistic missiles and supporting Houthi rebels in Yemen. President Trump says Iran was on the verge of collapse until the U.S. gave it a lifeline of $150 billion. That's a reference to the Iran nuclear deal reached last year with the U.S. and several world powers. Delaware prison officials say one hostage is dead and a second is alert and talking after authorities went into a building at the state's largest prison where inmates took staff members hostage. Officials say they have ended the disturbance after police breached the building. Officials say one corrections worker was found unresponsive and later pronounced dead. And Punxsutawney Phil saw his shadow this morning, meaning six more weeks of winter. The groundhog top hat wearing inner circle this morning gathered on Gobbler's Knob in Pennsylvania to deliver that news. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
I'm Stephanie Curtis.
And I'm Ewan Kerr. We're The Cube Critics.
We talk movies twice a week on The Cube Critics podcast.
Find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Friday Roundtable. This is going to be a great conversation. We're going to look at the present and the future of feminism. What are these marches that have come out in response to the election of Donald Trump? What do they mean? Is this kind of feminism today inclusive enough? We're going to tackle a lot of those hard questions, and I hope you'll tweet in. That's the Friday Roundtable, Friday at 9. Back to the conversation this hour. Steph Curtis and I, by the way, will have your letters, or maybe a small fraction of the letters that I've been getting from you. Back to the discussion this hour on immigration. Erica Lee with us from the University of Minnesota. And Erica, you reminded me of how broad this order is. I think you said the only people that are really exempted from this are diplomats. But if you're somebody who was born in the United States and you're traveling back and forth, you're not affected by this either.
No. And one of the problems with the rollout of the executive order was so much chaos in terms of who exactly does this apply to. But the broad ban specifically does affect, say, students, and we see that at the University
of Minnesota. Foreign students.
Okay. Students from these countries.
Right.
Students who have been cleared, who have visas, who have been accepted for graduate programs or other degree programs. They are affected by this ban.
Here's the thing I wanted to add. When I said if you were born in the United States and you, I meant to add, and you were going to some of these seven countries on this list, you shouldn't have a problem, should you?
It's unclear.
Okay.
That's one of the things, is that it is unclear. And things have changed, right? The directions from the Department of Homeland Security changed over the weekend. It really does depend on what kind of visa you have. If you're a naturalized citizen of the United States, there should not be a problem. But the LPR status, the legal permanent residence, the green card holders, I mean, this is one of the things that Kevin Johnson is saying, is that, you know, we don't want to encourage hysteria, but you really should be very careful.
Kevin, I was thinking about aid workers, and we have quite a tradition here in Minnesota of volunteering to international aid and providing help to some countries in need. If you are if you were born in the United States, but you have been serving and doing that kind of work in some of these countries, should you be concerned about being able to come back in?
I don't think that a U.S. citizen is likely to be denied reentry into the United States. I do think it's possible that if you're a U.S. citizen who travels to one of these countries, you could expect a likelihood that you might be questioned about your activities upon your reentry into the United States. And that's not always pleasant or fun or short. So I would suggest extreme care, but I have a hard time thinking that a citizen, absent one who's been involved in criminal activities, is going to run into much of a roadblock coming in, except for delays, questioning, and interrogations, and relatively short duration questioning.
Kevin, quick question here on Twitter. Jim is asking, who enforces the executive order or the court order? It's border control, I thought.
Well, it's the Customs and Border Protection Agency. It's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's primarily the Department of Homeland Security, although a number of other agencies are instructed to take some steps in the executive order. But it's primarily within the various arms of the Department of Homeland Security.
A question here from Ahmed in Minneapolis. Hey, Ahmed, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How about yourself?
Good. Thanks for the call. It sounds like you have a problematic situation here. You're about to get married?
I do, yeah. My wedding's in March, and I'm originally from Sudan. I'm now a naturalized U.S. citizen. I have a lot of family members and friends who will not be able to attend now as a result of this ban.
That's too bad.
Including some friends who are dual nationals they have a U.K. passport as well as a Sudanese passport. So I was curious if those people would be able to come if they're applying from Sudan. The other issue that I wanted to bring up is that I see that with myself and within a lot of people in my network who are professionals and have, you know, higher degrees and able to work anywhere in the world, anywhere else in the world, that there's going to be a mass exodus. A lot of us are discussing and actually making substantive moves to move outside of the U.S. And find employment elsewhere, because we do feel very much alienated by this executive order. Not having our families, for a lot of my friends' spouses and loved ones be able to visit, is something that no longer makes us feel as equal here. Yeah, and I think there's going to be a brain drain from a lot of people who have skills that allow them to work anywhere else in the world and find employment elsewhere, leaving the U.S. from these countries.
Ahmed, congratulations on the wedding. I hope you don't leave
too soon.
And thank you for the questions. Kevin, the dual nationals question here from Ahmed. What do you think?
Well, that's a fluid situation, but it appears that the U.S. government is taking the position that if you're a dual national and you're, one of your nationalities is one of the seven countries, that you're going to be subject to the kinds of restrictions that apply to people from one of those seven countries. So I don't think it protects you to be a dual national in this circumstance. And the second question, I do think that one of the reasons that Washington sued and one of the reasons I think Minnesota joined that suit is the concern that this policy is going to have an adverse impact on people's willingness to come and work in the United States, will have an economic impact on corporations and businesses in this country. It's a real tangible impact as well as the humanitarian impact of the impacts on people. And I think that's one of the reasons that the states are making these claims and are bringing these lawsuits that do take a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, Eric, I had hoped you might say something about that, the history of what this has meant, immigrants, what their efforts and their contributions have meant to Minnesota.
Absolutely. And I think Ahmed's point raises a very clear reflection and an example of the unintended consequences of these immigration laws. The fact that, one, some people may be leaving the country, those who we very much want to maintain in the United States. And then secondly, the ways in which, as Ahmed pointed out, that these laws make them feel less equal. You know, we've seen this before so many times in American history where we have singled out specific immigrant groups, allowing them to be in the United States, but not allowing them to feel fully American, to really segregate and marginalize them. And that is that's a dark chapter in our history that many of us thought we had left behind.
Call here from Olivia in Northfield. Hey, Olivia. Hi.
Hi.
Question or comment?
My question is in the context of the thought or fear that the other countries, it would be expanded to other countries. And I'm thinking with Trump's phone call to Mexico yesterday about all the bad dudes that might be extended to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
My daughter lives in Mexico. She's married to a Mexican citizen. They have a daughter. So my question is fourfold. How will it affect me going back and forth? How it will affect my daughter?
Okay.
How it would affect my son-in-law going back and forth? And how, I'm sorry, I'm going to try to be composed, how it would affect my ability to see my granddaughter and for her to come and visit me here. And I will hang up and listen.
Kevin, Mexico so far is not on the list.
No, it's not on the list. And those comments are sobering to me and make me sad, I have to say. I do think that we have to have special concern with Mexican immigrants right now. The first two orders really do focus on immigration from Mexico, and we have a history of some intolerance towards Mexican nationals and Mexican immigrants in this country, and that intolerance is something that candidate Trump tapped in one of his very first press conferences announcing he was running for president. I think that as a legal matter, travel by a U.S. citizen to Mexico is not likely to be problematic. I think it seems to me, and I tend to be pessimistic on these things, it seems to me it's unlikely that we're going to see Mexico added to the list of countries. At least last Friday's order.
Did you say you don't think that'll happen, or you do think it'll happen?
I don't think it'll happen. I don't see that happening. There's some crime problems in Mexico, but I don't see that links to terrorism in people's minds the way that President Trump has linked terrorism into the seven nations' minds. I do think that there may be very careful scrutiny, and although it's been a problem in the past of Mexican visa holders and lawful permanent residents returning to Mexico. I think that the biggest issue, and I couldn't sort of gather the citizenship of the grandchild, but getting a non-immigrant visa that's a temporary visa, it shouldn't be a problem, and I wouldn't imagine it being a big problem. But I do know that you have to go through a process if you're not a citizen if to get a temporary visa to visit the United States, and it appears there seems to be some friction between the United States and Mexican governments right now, involving all kinds of things, including the wall, including who's going to pay for the wall, including a possible tariff on Mexican goods. And what happens when you're having foreign policy disputes with another nation, and sometimes that affects visa applications, including temporary visa applications. So I think there's not a need to be unduly concerned about your granddaughter being able to get a visa with her mother. But it's something to be paying attention to.
Erica, Ryan wrote in to say, do constitutional challenges apply to non-U.S. citizens? He says, well, I may not agree with what President Trump is doing on this front, even if it was explicitly written as banning Muslim non-citizens, would that be unconstitutional? Do you know?
I think it depends. I think so one of the aspects of the state Attorney General's order demonstrated a broad legal offense of the executive order, one being due process. So it depends on whether those immigrants who are coming in have been able to have due process in terms of hearing their cases.
Call here from Dennis in Woodbury. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Carrie. Say, I was wondering how this relates is a national security issue. Since ISIS has, said that they were going to infiltrate refugees coming in, and I'm very sympathetic to people coming to this country. It just breaks my heart because I know there are people who need to come here. But at the same time, does national security, as President Trump being the commander in chief, does that really trump all of these other? Can he just stop people basically from coming in and say, well, we're not going to stop the Christians, but they didn't threaten to use, to come in as Christian refugees.
Okay.
They came in to come in as Muslims. Does that overcome basically all these other?
Yeah. Dennis, may I recommend our show yesterday to you? We had a conversation with two excellent guests where we talked about how to see these motivations around national security and the changes to immigration. But I will also ask Kevin if he'll weigh in on that. Kevin, do you have a view on that?
No, I do think that national security is a weighty concern, and it's something that's important to me. I'm sure it's important to Erica, and I'm sure it's important to all of us. The problem is taking measures that don't seem to be supported by the evidence in the name of national security. And we have some horrible incidents in our history where we overreacted to national security concerns and did things that we found to be completely regrettable. If you look at the Supreme Court decisions that upheld the Chinese exclusion laws in the late 1800s, among the many claims directed to the Chinese is they were a danger to national security and that hordes of people were going to destroy our country. If you look at the internment of a person's Japanese ancestry during World War II, you'll see actually falsified evidence used to justify a mass roundup of persons of Japanese ancestry in the name of national security. During the Depression, you see mass deportations of persons of Mexican ancestry, including U.S. citizens, in the name of securing the nation from the depths of the Great Depression, and it was viewed as sort of a national security concern to save the American economy. And after September 11, we see an incredible number of measures taken, detention and interrogations and the like, taken in the name of national security. So I think the Constitution doesn't turn off because there's a national security concern. At least there has to be a rational basis for the president to take some measures in the name of national security. And so I think it's not a place that's constitutionally immune, but a place where the courts have to be constitutionally careful.
Kevin, I know it's early in California. I'm really grateful for the time and the insight today. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Erica, just a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
For all the insight on the conversation.